Hello and welcome to the Third Opinion Uncensored, where we are allowed to speak openly about health, public health, wellness and censorship. Today we will be interviewing Dr. Robin Cosford. Robin holds a Bachelor of Medicine and Bachelor of Surgery with honours and has been a Fellow of the Australian College of Nutritional and Environmental Medicine in Australia. She was also a conjoint lecturer at the University of New South Wales and is an integrative medical practitioner and world-renowned speaker on autism and colonic bacterial patterns, amongst many other things. She lectures regularly at conferences, both internationally and nationally, and has written numerous articles for peer-reviewed journals and the public. She writes and speaks on many fascinating and non-traditional areas of research in medicine, including children's mental health, focusing on PANDAS, which stands for Pediatric Autoimmune Neuropsychiatric Disorders Associated with Streptococcal Infections, ADHD, and non-medication evidence-based treatments for a range of childhood ills. She is currently one of the directors and the chair of the Children's Health Defence Australian chapter. She has had a 35-year career as an integrative medical specialist and has helped hundreds of clients overcome health issues ranging from minor irritations through to life-threatening illnesses, which have, in many cases, been written off as incurable by the mainstream medical system. Robin, welcome to the Third Opinion. How are you today?
Welcome, Eva. Great. Thank you for inviting me in. Great to be here. What an introduction. My goodness.
Well, that's your life. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. I'm very excited to be speaking with you and asking you questions about your life, your career, your research, and your thoughts about where things are at the moment. So to begin, I'd like to start at the very beginning. Why did you become a doctor?
Great question. As a kid, I just knew that we were made, and I just knew this. I wasn't taught it, but that we were made out of what we ate. So I was a fussy child, not in the normal sense of modern fussy where kids won't eat vegetables. I was the opposite. I wouldn't eat sweets, and I would carefully load my plate up with good stuff. It's strange, isn't it?
Were you taught that? Was that what your mother wanted you to do, or that's what you wanted to do?
No, that was what I wanted to do. Although I do distinctly remember my mother force feeding me soggy lettuce soaked in French dressing when I was small. But I love lettuce with dressings on it these days, but it's picked from the garden, super fresh and super crunchy, so it's a bit different. But it was just something, because by this time when I was making these choices, my mum wasn't with us. So this was what I was doing. And I always had this tendency to be wanting to fix things and help people and, you know, heal. And I remember doing that for my grandmother, who had nasty burns one time, and then put my first dislocated knee in on the field when I was 12. Dislocated knee, the knee of one of my gymnast colleagues. So I was just always doing that. So it was really just, and I always just knew I wanted to go into medicine. So, yeah.
That's beautiful and fortunate, I think, that you found your calling so young in life as well. What made you become an integrative medical practitioner? Because you didn't just stay with medicine. You took another step. So if you could explain a little bit about what an integrative medical practitioner is and why you made that choice.
I actually prefer to call myself a functional medicine practitioner to an integrative practitioner. Mm-hmm. Most of our, let's say integrative practitioners are doctors first and then add nutrition or whatever on after that. Whereas I came it the other way around. As I said, I knew that we were made out of what we ate. And I came at it from a naturopathic perspective to begin with. I actually had completed my training in nutrition, naturopathy, herbs, homeopathy, and so on before I finished medicine. So I did that. I took a break in the middle of my medical degree and did that while I had my next three of my five children. So it wasn't a case of kind of adding stuff onto medicine. It was actually the other way around, that I was adding medicine onto a basis of let's say, naturopathic healing. Of it's a totally different way of thinking. It's just a totally different way of thinking that unfortunately not many doctors get back to, because we are so instilled in this idea that what you have to do is identify the disease process name, not the disease process per se, but what's the name you're going to give the process, put that into a box, and then find the drug that fits the box. So the medical training trains you out of, actively trains you out of thinking what has gone on in the person to create this disease process. That's irrelevant as far as standard medicine's concerned. So it's a very different way of thinking and approaching things.
Absolutely. And I love the way you've described that. You're no longer working actively as a medical practitioner, are you?
That's right. I retired my license in January of last year. The system has not been in favour, shall we say, putting it politely, of doctors doing integrative or functional medicine for a long time. Indeed, many of my colleagues in the same age bracket I'm in, most of them, I could go as far as to say, have already been taken out of the system, who are seriously practicing integrative medicine. I see patients for a long time because I tend to do very complex conditions, not your standard GP stuff. I am getting the very complex conditions, generally ones that have been through multiple other doctors before they've come to me. Mm-hmm. And so it is fairly common, fairly usual for a first consult for me to be 2 hours. I'm taking an entire history, the patient history, the family history. I'm taking a health wellness history, a lifestyle history. I want to know what they're eating, what's their profile like, you know, what's their daily life like, yeah. What illnesses have been handed down, what drugs have they had, and so on and so on. So typically the first consult will be a 2 hour consult, and the follow ons will be an hour.
So it's that first consultation is where you are effectively the health detective trying to identify where things have gone wrong so that you can find out the underlying pathology or what's triggering where they are today.
Absolutely. I refuse, unless we've got someone who's just, you know, come in with an acute urgent situation where you have to rapidly do something on the spot, I refuse to be dispensing, making recommendations without knowing what's the actual scenario, what's this patient's actual underlying pathology, what's the process that over the years has led up to them being where they are now.
So this was identified as you doing something that is, what would they say is wrong with that? Because from what you're saying to me, I'm hearing that as a doctor, you're someone that listens, that actually wants to know what's going on, are interested in the background noise of my life, and really trying to find the things that might be triggering me on a whole many different levels, which can contribute to me being unwell. What is seen as wrong about that?
Well, the only real complaint that they can make is that it is outside their construct. They want, now the bizarre thing, it actually costs the system less. I cost the system way less than your standard GPs.
Explain.
Because the per minute rate on Medicare, doctors get, and this is part of the incentive for the healthcare, the health clinics and so on, the medical clinics, where doctors churn through patients for only 5 minutes at a time. Why is that? It is because the Medicare system is geared that the maximum rebate a doctor will get for seeing a patient occurs at the 5 minute mark. Once you hit 20 minutes, if you're bulk billing, once you hit 20 minutes, the doctor is actually paying to see the patient, because the rebate that's got back per minute drops dramatically, and it doesn't even cover your practice running costs.
So the patient is paying for that extra time.
Well, the patient has to pay or the doctor can't do it.
Okay, so it's not, financial load on the system.
That's right. It's not because integrative doctors are a financial load on the system. Oh. Well, certainly I wasn't. We cost the system less in Medicare rebates. We cost the system far less. Pathology testing I used to do mostly private. So again, it wasn't costing the system. The patient would need to bear that cost. And I wrote very, very few scripts. I made very few specialist referrals because I was able to handle most of what was coming in. So I actually cost the system very little, but the system didn't like me because I wasn't operating within the system. I wasn't doing it all the way they want it done. They want it done that GPs only see people for 5 minutes at a time. They're writing out lots of scripts. They're not doing much pathology testing, and they refer everything that's at all complicated across to the specialists.
So in terms of success of your methodology, you're seeing patients that tend to have had failures with other medical interventions, correct? Is that who's coming to you?
Yeah.
And how successful are they in terms of the outcomes?
I am used to seeing my patients improve and often totally come out of their diagnosis.
Okay.
That's what I expect. At the very least, I always expect improvement. Mm-hmm. And as I said, often we can reverse the actual diagnosis. Not always, but often.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the types of diagnosis that you are reversing, because that's absolutely fascinating. And I think that I see that you're treating ADHD, that you're treating things like autism, that you're treating things that other doctors really don't even address except with medication. So do you want to tell me a little bit about what are your favorite diseases to treat and what are you seeing the most success with?
Yeah, that's a good question. With all of any disease name that might come in, it is very much about finding, well, what are the underlying factors? Now, if I can find enough underlying factors, if I can find, for example, okay, we've got abnormal gut bacteria and they can be there for several reasons. If I find we've got a terrible diet, if I find that we've got on further metabolic testing, we've got mitochondrial dysfunction. And in a sense, the more, if I find on mineral testing that we've got heavy metal loads and we've got deficiency of nutritional minerals and your vitamins. In a sense, the more things that I find both in history and in testing for that person, then the more avenues I have to be able to reverse what's happened for them.
Okay, so let me just go through those just quickly. So for abnormal gut bacteria, how do you test for that? Because that's not something that your standard medical practitioner would be testing for, is it?
No, your standard medical practitioner definitely is not. So there are very particular types of stool testing. I have a personal favourite because of the research I was doing with the University of Newcastle back in the late 1990s, you know, early 2000s. Mm-hmm. So the team then was working on chronic fatigue syndrome. Mm-hmm. And at that stage, that University Newcastle team were world leaders in chronic fatigue syndrome research. So it was an exciting time to be involved with them. So what we were looking at was membrane fatty acids, urinary metabolites, and gut bacterial profiles. Mm-hmm. So this was way before gut bacteria were at all popular or known about.
Yeah.
And so that's where... That's really where it all started. So I started also investigating using their same testing methods. I started investigating my children with autism and ADHD and discovered that we were really looking, particularly with the children with autism, the same metabolic profiles as you have with adults with chronic fatigue. It's just that the onset has come at a younger age. So it really is.
So in this case, then you're saying that there actually is evidence-based through testing in areas such as autism, where people seem to be, or medical practitioners seem to be confused about the origins of it. And you're saying that you can show that there are correlations and links with abnormal gut biota.
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. Diet. Absolutely. Let's just, I could be speaking to you for many hours, but I'm just going to quickly go through some things because I just want to get an overview of the things that you do, and perhaps we can get you back at another time to go deeper into some specifics around certain disease states. Diet, with diet?
Well, again, diet is a huge component of what's going on now for multiple reasons. But the first and possibly most important thing is that when we eat, the first thing we feed is our gut bacteria. It doesn't feed us. First thing we feed is our gut bacteria. So if we are eating a diet high in refined carbohydrates, high in sugar, high in carbs in general, there's a particular group of bacteria that will be fed by that and they will make toxins from it. It doesn't, a diet like that, which is our standard typical modern kids' diet, white food, sugar, sugar, white food, that diet does not feed the healthy gut bacteria that we need. And the same thing's happening with our adults. So then you add the artificial colours, flavours, preservatives, everything else that's in those types of foods as well. And the fact that those foods are totally deficient, pretty much totally deficient. The more you refine a food, the more deficient it is of all your micronutrients, of magnesium, zinc particularly, but also your B vitamins. And so that factor as well, and phytonutrients. This is another really important part that's totally lost in a white food diet, is all the phytonutrients. The phytonutrients are the things that we get in our coloured foods, our coloured vegetables, and there's mounting research on the absolute necessity of these for health for our system and for our gut bacteria. So diet is crucial.
And everything that you're saying is backed up by a ton of science. I'm aware of that. And I think that's important to know that this isn't just random, that there is just a ton of evidence, but unfortunately this isn't part of the marketing strategy for most processed food companies. So it doesn't really get
exactly the time
that it needs to. So if a listener was going to do one or two things, what would be your number one thing that you would say to someone to remove from a diet or to add to a diet?
Added sugar. Any food with added sugar, whether it's a packet food, whether it's a soft drink, whether you're putting sugar in your tea or your coffee, the first thing that must go is sugar, because until sugar, we now know, has got an addictive effect equivalent to cocaine. Mm-hmm. And so the sugar is very much feeding the wrong gut bacteria. It is sending blood sugar levels high and low, unstable, high and low. And the combination of those things sets up for sugar cravings, so that you just go back for more and more sugar to try and get that quick fix to get the blood sugar levels back up again. But they can't stay up. Sugar does not have, it's a catch-22, refined white sugar doesn't contain, again, we're back to saying magnesium, B vitamins, that are needed to metabolize the sugar. So the body can't deal with it properly. So then we go into all the flow-on problems that come from that, irritation for the brain, the sugar getting metabolized across into the fat stores and causing insulin resistance and the flow-on from that down the track, diabetes, inflammation in the body, and on it goes. And so sugar.
That domino effect, and you know, there's obviously a number of dominoes that you would like to get rid of, and it's complex. And I think what becomes difficult for patients or clients or just, you know, people listening to this to understand is just how far-reaching the simple actions are around removing something as simple as sugar. And I say I'm a health and wellness coach, and I say to my clients, just test it for 4 weeks and see. You know, just do a little bit of a test. Don't do it forever. Just try it out and see. And people are often so surprised the far-reaching consequences of making small changes. The mitochondrial function that you mentioned, how would you test for that? Maybe tell us.
There's a fairly specific test that can be done through different private labs called urinary organic acid testing. Mm-hmm. So what this is looking for is particular patterns of metabolites in the urine, and according to the pattern that turns up, these are markers that relate back to the function of the citric acid cycle or Krebs cycle, which is the cycle in the body that converts glucose, or the down product from glucose, acetyl-CoA, down into energy. Mm-hmm. So we want for markers of that. The urinary organic acids also give us markers around inflammation. They give us markers around some nutrient deficiencies. They give us markers around neurotransmitter function.
So if someone's really struggling with their energy levels, this would be something that could reveal something that might be missed.
Exactly.
Standard doctor. Is that
yeah.
Would a normal GP be looking at it? No, okay.
Normal GPs wouldn't do this. Certainly with anyone with fatigue, you deal with the obvious first things. Make sure they don't have an iron deficiency. Make sure they don't have thyroid dysfunction. You know, two big obvious things that we have to do first. And you'd probably also check B12. Mm-hmm. So those are the things that a standard doctor, you know, would expect they would have done. Mm-hmm. But if the problem's not resolved and we've still got other ongoing things, then you need to start thinking, okay, well, there's another reason for this fatigue. So let's have a look at, is the body actually able to make energy? Okay. Are the mitochondria actually dysfunctional?
Mineral testing. How do you do that? Do you use hair mineral testing? What do you use? Is it blood
Well,
testing?
there are a couple of ways to do things. And what we need to understand that again, doctors don't seem to remember and patients don't understand is that the body has what we call compartmentalization. And that is that depending on which part of the body tissues or excreta we choose to measure, we are going to get to see different things. So the body works very hard to keep all its nutrients and its pH very even in the blood. The blood's got a very narrow pH level, it's got a very narrow nutrient levels. So if we see something wrong in the blood, we know that it is certainly a reflection of something going on elsewhere. Doesn't mean, so for example, people using blood to look for mercury. Unless you've literally just swallowed a mercury thermometer and you have acute high levels of mercury, then we're not going to see mercury in the blood because the body knows that mercury is highly toxic stuff and it shouldn't be in the blood. So it gets it out of the blood as quickly as it can and shovels it away. It can't be left out in the open. It's a highly toxic, not mineral. Well, yes, it is a mineral, but it's highly toxic substance. So the body buries it as deep in the tissues as it can so it can keep functioning. Same thing with lead. If a child turns up with a high blood level, then that means they've got new current lead exposure. Because past lead, the body will bury until it can't bury it anymore.
So where does it
So,
bury?
bone is a key place, but often it ends up in neural tissue. These things often end up deep in the nervous system as well.
So how do you test for that?
You can't test it directly. We don't have a Dr. Spock scanner that enables us to just scan the whole body and get a reflection of, what's there. We're not up to that yet. So we've got to look in different compartments and use that as a reflection of what's going on for the areas that we want to test. So if we've got people with neurodegenerative disorders, for example, who've got a history of having some sort of mercury source, well, what would that be? Well, a lot of people when they were kids, older people when they were kids, used to play with mercury. We used to do it in the science labs. We'd put it on the floor and roll it around and pick it up and say, "Isn't this fantastic stuff?"
Amazing, wasn't it?
It was amazing stuff, yeah. But we all got a degree of mercury coming across our skin. So you pull out the history. You look, do they have a history of silver amalgams? Mercury, they're actually mercury. Mercury silver bonded amalgams. Do they have amalgams? We know from again from studies that have been done that every time you chew on a mouthful of mercury amalgams, mercury vapor is released into the mouth, and that travels across directly across the cribriform plate right up into the brain, an immediate transfer. So you look for these things in the history. If they've got a history of vaccines prior to only, I think it was about 5 years ago they did it when they pulled thimerosal out of the kids' ones, it's still in some others. If
Thanks
there's a history of
for
vaccines.
the work of Kylie Muse, who I'm hoping to speak with soon. There was actually advocacy had to happen to do that. It didn't happen without the help of citizens who were asking.
That's right.
And actually, because it wasn't coming from the TGA, the removal of
No.
from the vaccines.
Oh, no. And we need to note when it was pulled, there was no announcement anywhere of admitting anything to do with the mercury being a problem. It's just, oh, yeah, it's not there anymore. That's all. No explanation why. It's like, well, why have you now decided it's not there? You're not going to admit. So, and this is the nature. So you want to go looking into the history. So you look first and see, well, is there a history to make us suspect that mercury could be there? And then we do these other testing. As I said, I don't even bother testing for blood mercuries because unless they've literally just played with a thermometer or they've literally just had their mercury teeth pulled, it's useless. It's a useless test.
And is
Some people do.
hair testing at all useful? Sorry, just
Hair
one.
testing is a, so we again, we need to understand what we're testing with each of these things. A hair test does not give you a reflection of what's in the body necessarily, because hair is an excretion organ. What the hair actually tests is how much of these minerals is the body excreting into the hair. That's what it tests. And that can be dependent both on the body burden, but also on the body's ability to excrete it. If the body is deficient in the nutrients it needs to excrete it, then we're not going to see it in the hair. If the body has got blocks on mineral transporters to get it out because of other toxins and so on, we're not going to see it in the hair. So the hair is not a direct reflection of what is in the system. And that's where a lot of people go wrong with it. Mm. It's a reflection of what can the body excrete and what did it excrete in the last 3 months.
So, but on the one hand, there might be an absence of things so that you don't see it. But if you do see that something is being excreted in high levels, that is an indicator that there was a high level in the body as well. So there is potential for it to be valuable.
It's still a useful test, but it's all about the interpretation of it. And a one-off test is not in itself that valuable. It needs to be tested as you are treating to see whether, because what I used to find would happen would be that about 6 months after I started treating people, suddenly we would see the release of the heavy metals coming out in hair, right? So it required corrections to the system first before the body was able to mobilize that.
Robin, what I'm hearing is that it's highly complex work, and the value of having someone like you who can look at these complexities, understand them, treat them, and the value for the patient to be guided in this is unparalleled, because if these things are being missed, which obviously they are, I wonder who's going to fill these gaps. How many people are there like you in Australia who are able to do this sort of work? And if people like you are leaving the profession, where does that leave us?
It is a challenge. It is a problem. There are varying degrees of training and practitioners trained in nutritional environmental medicine. We used to be able to, ACNM, Australian College of Nutritional and Environmental Medicine, is still operating, and they are still doing training. So that's a good place for people often to start. There's other practitioners who've been trained through the Mind Foundation. And this started off initially being more about children's disorders, but again, that's a good place to start.
And that's MIND.
And then other than that, MIND. Yeah, the Mind Foundation.
And that's mainly for health practitioners. Is there anything for people that are not trained in the health area? Not, are they for just citizens to learn more about these conditions and understanding the fundamentals of functional medicine and nutritional environmental medicine? Where would you begin?
Yeah, good question. I've actually just put together a thing called the Healthy 100. Well, not just, it's been the work of many years, but it is now actually on a website and now available. The Healthy 100, which is a baseline program to teach people how to take control of their own health and their own wellness. And it's, the concept is of a wheel. So it's the wheel of life, the Healthy 100 wheel of life concept is of a wheel. And that if things are going to be balanced and roll well, and we're going to live to a healthy, ripe old age, healthy, not just old age, healthy, that everything needs to be in balance. So the concept is of seven spokes in a wheel. And the central hub, and the central hub's love, joy, peace. So we have seven spokes that need to be addressed, and then we have the central thing of the state of the soul and the spirit, love, joy, peace. And so that's now available.
What's the website for that? Thank you.
So that's now available on my website, Revaya Life, R-E-V-A-Y-A, revayalife.com.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay.
So people can just look at the basic bit and just get the basic idea. If they really want to dive deep, there is a 14-week, 1.5 to 2 hour video, deeper training series that really digs into it for those who want to go deeper.
Oh, amazing. Okay.
So there's levels to it.
You really had the answer to my question then, didn't you? That's great. And I didn't know about that. So that's excellent to hear that there is a resource for people. And I think taking control with two hands of your own health means that you have to know what's possible, especially if your health practitioners don't. And then you have to find out
exactly
who can meet you where you are. And the more you know, the more potential there is for you to find the solutions to whatever ills that you're going through. But let me pivot now to your role at the Children's Health Defence, because I have a great interest in childhood health, being having seen what's been happening more recently here in Australia. Tell me about your role there, and what is the reason that the Children's Health Defence has come to Australia, and how did that emerge?
So the background first: the Children's Health Defence is an organisation founded in the US in 2011 by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. So he is an environmental lawyer. So he was actually fighting Monsanto. And so it came out as a result of the things he was doing with environmental law, a bit like happened with Andy Wakefield. Got approached by, some mums to say, well, come and have a look at this. And so he started to see the environmental impact on children's health. From there, moved across into looking at questions around vaccines and so children's health defence.
New book that's just come out, Turtles All the Way Down, Vaccine Myths and Facts, I think it's called Facts, which has come out of Israel, and it was recently translated from the Hebrew, but the author is anonymous because they didn't want to be trolled and
labeled.
And so it's got 1,200 references, peer-reviewed references in this book around the many problems around the vaccines and the research, and why we should be really questioning. And in the light of everything happening with COVID, we really need to dig a little bit deeper into the ethics of how things get approved and our own approval systems here in Australia.
Absolutely. I think it's very telling that in 1986, in the US, the pharmaceutical industry approached the government and said, look, we need, if we're going to keep doing vaccines, we need indemnity for the side effects from them. That happened in 1986, that the vaccine industry was granted indemnity from any side effects of any vaccine on the childhood schedule. So when you look at that.
That in America, did that first happen?
That was it.
And then
that first happened in America, and it's followed on to here. When you look at that and then look at the time scale of release of childhood vaccines since then. So prior to 1986, we had very few. We basically only had the DTP. MMR had just come out. That came out 1982, I think it was. So the MMR had only just come out, and that was showing problems. So the vaccine industry kind of said, oh, no, we're not going to, we need you to cover us because we can't afford to pay out on all these problems. We can't afford to keep doing vaccines. So on the basis of that, we then have a situation where you think this through logically. Think this through if you were going to buy a car and the car manufacturer said, no, I'm not liable if anything goes wrong with this car. I'm just selling you the car. I'm telling you it's fine, but I'm just selling you this car. I'm not liable for anything. Would you buy the car from that manufacturer?
Absolutely not.
Yeah, I don't think so. So we've got this crazy situation where we have indemnified the manufacturers of something, which means that they don't have any incentive whatsoever to perform strict duty of care, to perform careful analyses and studies and comparisons and post-marketing surveillance and so on and so on. Most people don't know that for each of your childhood vaccines, they get approved on testing that effectively is only for a few weeks, at best a couple of months. There is no long-term testing comparing the health of children's vaccines to those who are unvaccinated. And each of the vaccine trials, the so-called placebos, are always another vaccine.
So hang on. So you're saying rather than testing the vaccine against, like, saline or a placebo,
saline,
they're doing it against another vaccine
that's already been approved.
So you're saying
they do it against,
because they've brought in the hexavalent vaccine now for 2-month-old babies, which they give along with two other vaccines. So a 2-month-old baby now in Australia is recommended to get 8 vaccines at once.
That's right.
And one of them is pertussis, is the Hep B vaccine, which surprises me. Because why are we in Australia giving children Hep B vaccines. I mean, that really is confusing. But now that they've put it into the hexavalent vaccine, it doesn't seem like parents have any choice. And if they don't get vaccinated, then they don't get money from the government to support
the family them. Benefits. Exactly. Wow. That was the whole beginning of the thing of control and linking it to our dependence on government for finances.
But why would they be encouraging vaccines that, I mean, from what you're saying, proper testing hasn't been done? Doesn't the TGA have a role in ensuring that proper testing is done? And wouldn't parents be speaking out if there are consequences on their children?
TGA should be performing proper testing. And it's been highlighted because of this issue of what's happened with the recommendations for the COVID vaccine and children. That in fact, there's something wrong with that regulatory process.
Like what?
They're approving things that are not safe and have not been fully tested. Simple.
Who's funding the TGA? Isn't that a government organisation?
The TGA is hugely funded by the pharmaceutical industry. What the TGA does is it charges each pharmaceutical industry a fee to approve their medication. And so the this catch, you know, it's like the pharmaceutical industry wants their medications approved, so they pay a fee to get it approved. So of course then the TGA is going to make sure it approves their medication. They've just paid a fee for it, and they're dependent on the pharmaceutical industry paying the fees.
I've just found the article about that, and it says Marianne DeMussy wrote this article for the British Medical Journal. It says 96% of TGA funding is coming from the pharmaceutical industry. In Australia, it looks like we're the number one in the world. We've got the highest drug company.
There we go.
Just can't understand how that's...
I know. It's unbelievable. You know, again, when you think, we've got to think this through logically and how can an independent regulator regulate if they're paid by the people they're regulating?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, really, where's the logic? There's no logic in that.
We could do a very deep dive into this, which we won't do now, but let's talk about the problems that we're seeing. And I guess why the Children's Health Defence emerged around the consequences of these huge childhood vaccine schedules. How many vaccines are now approved or expected for a child in Australia under the age of 5, for example?
Yeah, once we get to 5, I think the latest count when I last looked was 35, I think it was. It keeps going up and things are being added all the time.
It must be more because they're doing 8 now at 2 months and they're doing 8 at 4 months.
But it drops off.
Oh, does it?
But it drops off after that. Yeah. The 2, 4, 6 are the intense ones.
Okay.
It drops off dramatically after that.
Okay.
But nonetheless, the issue that we've got is that, again, while they might do a short test, few weeks testing on the new individual vaccines they're bringing in, there is no testing done on this full schedule.
Hang on.
The TGA, the CDC, all of these, there is no testing that has ever been done comparing what happens to the health of children who have been vaccinated on this schedule compared to children who are not vaccinated. They have not done any of those studies.
So literally there is no placebo trials, no RCTs, nothing.
No.
So we've got nothing to compare it to.
We've got nothing to compare it to because they don't do the comparisons. Now, we do have situations now where retrospectively, actually only just, or 2020, just prior to COVID, we had two independent doctors in the US go through their records and publish based on that, compared the fully vaccinated children compared to the unvaccinated children have got significant, and it varied on the diseases they looked at, whether they were looking at asthma, allergies, ADHD, autism, and so on, varying between 2, 10, and sometimes up to 50 times increased incidence of these diseases in your highly vaccinated as compared to your unvaccinated.
Wow.
Now, these aren't accepted by the system. You know, they're simply not accepted. And we're never going to be able to set up a government-approved prospective trial because they don't want anyone. Firstly, they're not allowing any kids to not be vaccinated. It's increasingly difficult for parents to not vaccinate their children. They can if they're prepared to opt out of the system and if they're prepared to not receive government funding. But getting a full prospective trial up and running to compare head-to-head the health of your vaccinated and unvaccinated children has not been done. It would theoretically be possible. Funding would be an issue. And where we could get ethics approval would also be an issue. So it's a big problem.
Sounds like a huge problem. And given that we're having this accelerating amount of asthma, autoimmune disease, allergies, autism, etc., you can only assume that the health of our children is not going forward, but in fact going backwards. And obviously this would be the first thing you would look at because this is such a major change, and we do see that vaccines have got some more major impacts. There is the, have you looked at the research of Dr. Christine Stabel-Benn?
Don't think I know her stuff.
She looked at 10 childhood vaccines at all-cause mortality. So her focus is on all-cause
mortality. On the all-cause mortality. And I haven't seen that one. That'd be good to see.
Yeah, she's done some interesting research. She even did a TED Talk around it. And she actually says that the vaccines that had the greatest positive impact on all-cause mortality were the live attenuated viruses. And she's in fact saying, you know, and she's not coming out of, you know, being anti-vaccine at all. She's very much interested in what vaccinations work well from an all-cause mortality perspective. I mean, what's the value of a vaccine if it helps you with one disease, but then sets you back with a whole bunch of other diseases? And that's what she's looking at. She's looking at the impact on the immune system in general. Tell me about autism, because I just know that in America, I've you know, looked at the data there in terms of the numbers, and it was very interesting what you said about that there is, you're seeing signals in the gut through the type of testing that you do. What's the increase in autism in this country over the last
20 years? It's worth put it all into context for people. In 1985, the reported incidence of autism, this was Eric Fomboni's paper, was only 4 in 100,000. So back in 1985, 4 in 100,000. And we're looking at a situation. So Australian figures are a bit hard to nail down, but we are probably approaching the 1 in 50 mark. We're probably approaching that. We don't have very good figures to access. US is now approaching 1 in 32. So we've gone from 4 in 100,000 to, let's say, 3%, 2 to 3%. And in fact, most people, if you think about it yourselves, you would realize that you would know someone who's autistic. You will either have an autistic child in your family or you will know a family who's got a child who's autistic. Whereas when I went through med, to find an autistic child, we had to go to the autism school to find them because they weren't around.
I remember. Right? And I remember working in physiotherapy with children with disabilities, and it was rare. And I guess it's when I mentioned this, you know, change in numbers, you know, I didn't realize it was that great here. People just say that's because autism is now being diagnosed, whereas before it wasn't. And I just hear people repeat memes, and I'm just curious what you think, and in terms of treatment, what have you had success with?
Well, I think we just come back to common sense. You know an autistic child in the community when you meet them.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
They weren't there before. They weren't there before. So, no, it's not just that we're getting better at diagnosis. You could factor a little bit in as being better at diagnosis, but not the dramatic increases we've seen. It would be really incredibly insulting to all parents and all doctors to say that this situation we've got here now was here before, but we just didn't see it.
I met someone a few weeks ago, and she was talking about her 21-year-old autistic son. And explaining, you know, how she's, you know, I mean, he's highly functional, but he has challenges. And I asked her, when did you know he was autistic? And she said, 18 months. And then I realized, I said, did it happen overnight? Did it happen suddenly? And she said, yes. And then I asked the obvious question, was it associated with vaccination? And she looked at me and she said, well, the doctors at the time said it wasn't. And it's been 20 years since then, so it's not worth even thinking about. What do you say when people tell you, and they're completely convinced, that it's not true, that there isn't a link between childhood vaccinations and autism? What would you say?
There are several different answers to that. Firstly, the work that was done by CDC to come out and say there is no link. When you break that down, even in their own data, they had to admit that in the male Afro-Americans, there was a four to 10 times increased risk. So even they had to admit that for that subset. There was a lot of concern at that time because one of the guys in that original group turned whistleblower and stated that what they actually did was they binned a whole heap of the data.
And that's what came out in the movie Vaxxed, wasn't it? The movie that was meant to open up the Tribeca Film Festival and got shut down.
Yeah, well, it was out. It was out before then for those of us who were in the field. We knew that, but Vaxxed put it out into the public. Okay. So we have, again, another classic case, as has been happening with the COVID injection, where the powers that be are conveniently hiding and falsifying data to be able to keep the narrative up. They couldn't have it seen. Now, what's interesting, before we had the neonatal Hep B introduced, the typical pattern of autism was for one of regression, that they would be progressing normally to around the 12, 18-month mark and then tip over. That was your typical pattern, a regressive pattern. So at that stage, 18 months, 12 to 18 months was the time of administration of the MMR, and it wasn't linked with the DTP at that stage. So at that stage, we had the MMR. So there was a period in time where we had a correlation between the timing of the MMR and then a regressive autism. But since they're put in the neonatal Hep B, the babies are being injected before they leave the delivery suite. We now do not get a chance to see this child not injected. We don't know what is the actual normal for this child because it has never been seen. The child is injected directly in the delivery suite. And the neonatal Hep B is known to be an immunologically acting vaccine. The brain cells sit in a basket weave of immune cells. We're getting effects on the brain right from the word go now.
How does a Hep B be approved for a newborn child whose parent has no risk of, you know, I understand if the
exactly
parent is a drug user or that if you're living in a country where Hep B is endemic. How does this get approved in Australia?
But even if you're in a place where Hep B is endemic, the point is Hep B is transmitted only by bodily fluids. A newborn baby is not about to engage in unprotected sex. They're not about to start using IV drugs. They're not about to start going out playing blood contact sports, right? They, unless their mother is a Hep B carrier, they are at no risk of hepatitis B, close to zero risk. So it was introduced, the whole reason for the introduction of the, or justification for the introduction of the Hep B vaccine was that we have a captive audience, the baby's already there, rather than, no, we're not going to bother testing the mothers to see if they've got Hep B and just selectively vaccinate those whose mothers have got Hep B. We'll just do the entire population. And that was the justification at the time.
What is there treatment that works? I guess that's the question for most. And do parents have a choice? Can they choose not to do Hep B? I can understand that parents get anxious about pertussis, maybe about measles, maybe about rubella. Is there a way to identify the vaccines that you want to have and might be seen as more valuable and not be given the other ones? Because it just seems...
To a degree, the first challenge for a parent, sorry, I'm losing my voice here. The first challenge for a parent is to find a doctor who is on board with them. That's their first challenge. Mm-hmm. They can themselves make sure that the Hep B is not given in hospital. You've got to write, you've got to guard your baby, and you've got to write in red all over the paperwork, but you can ensure that the neonatal Hep B is not given to the bub in hospital. For the other vaccines after that, you need to find a doctor who will work with you. But yes, you can separate out the injections to a degree. You know, you can work a delay process. You can do these things, but only if you've got a doctor who's on side with you. And therein lies the challenge. Wow. So, you know, prior to when I surrendered my license, I was separating out the vaccines and I was doing other things to mitigate the side effects and watching very closely and not going any further if we saw any issues and so on.
Like, what would you see? So say that the a baby had not been given the Hep B at birth and at 2 months they have their first injection. What could you see? Like, what signs of change would you be?
Well, you're looking for any behavioral change, any change in gut function, any change in immune system. So if a bubby who was a previously settled bubby suddenly becomes unsettled and distressed, if suddenly their stool changes and they start getting horrible mucusy, or, you know, they have difficulty with stool or getting mucusy stool, or, you know, blood in the stool, any of those sorts of things. If suddenly their feeding pattern changes or their sleeping pattern changes, you know, so you want to delay them all as much as you can and break them up as much as you can, not give everything all at once. And you can, as I said, you can do that if you've got an on-site medical practitioner.
Robin, is this information part of the course that you are speaking about, your healthy life?
So, there are levels of everything. The Healthy 100 is designed as a baseline health package to get people to get their health back on track. Mm-hmm. Behind that, I'm doing a thing called the School of Divine Health, mm-hmm. which is an every week, 1 hour, through just progressively working our way through all things.
Maybe we can do a whole session around this, and just with the work of the Children's Health Defence. I know we've run over time now, and I just wonder, if you could guide parents to somewhere where they could start to look into this. And I guess the question is, if parents are concerned about this sort of thing, what I understand is that you can look at the gut, you can look at the toxins, you can look at the diet, and you can also look at prevention through not continuing to vaccinate with the things that might have triggered these changes in the child. Is that am I right to think they're the kind?
That's pretty much it. And looking at the minerals, I don't just do the hair tests, I do tissue testing as well. That's another story. But the mind, so it's Mind Foundation, so it's just mind.org, MIND.org.
No AU, okay. And in terms of detoxification, is there any pathways for detoxification, or is that related?
Lots you can do. Oh, there's lots you can do for detoxification. So, and that's a huge lot of talking in itself, but there's many, many ways you can do that. But the first thing is to fix the baseline, get the baseline working, mm-hmm. get the right foods, get the life framework in place, mm-hmm. right? You don't want to launch into an intense, expensive detox type program if you're planning to go back and eat and do everything else the same way.
My final question is, have you seen recovery of kids who have come to you with autism through these different aspects of changes?
Absolutely. I've got numbers of children who are totally out of the spectrum, and IQ being measured, children who also were severe developmental delay, IQ jumping. We've seen all of this, and I expect to see change. As I said earlier, not every child will be able to be fully restored. It does depend. With all of these things, the question we don't know until we hit it is, what fixed damage have we got as compared to dysfunction? There's a difference between damage and dysfunction. Okay. And we don't know until we've hit it whether we've got damage here or whether we're just dysfunction. But dysfunction can be treated and reversed. But certainly in my books, diet and gut are absolutely paramount. If we don't address diet and we don't look at the gut and address the gut, then we're not going to make a lot else, because the state of the immune system is determined by the gut. The autoantibody reactions into the brain, you know, get triggered in the gut. Toxins coming in from the gut, toxins coming from the bacteria in the gut, and so on.
I want to thank you, Robin. I will need to have you come back on, and I think there'll be a lot of questions from the audience, and perhaps we can go into more depth around some of this. And I'm really curious about how do we support people to choose what is better for their children's health, given that there's all these uncertainties and all these risks. And that sense of, I mean, you know, that's one thing about the COVID vaccine and that story, but to think that children, that babies at the day they're born are being vaccinated against something that is entirely unnecessary is quite shocking to hear. And yeah, I'd like to understand what can people do? You know, how can we respond to that? You know, it sounds like that if people understood this better, they would all want to do something, but you know, is there a mechanism to do that? And is that what the Children's Health Defence is here for? Is that what the Australian chapter is here to help us do?
Certainly. Well, you know, the mission is about looking at these children's, the current children's epidemics, what's causing them, what are the toxins involved, what are the other factors involved, if this is the result of, well, we want to call it malfeasance or incompetence or other issues in government, or bringing those people to account who are allowed these things to happen, and bringing change. You know, we have to increase awareness and we have to bring change.
Thank you very, very much for all your work. Your commitment and your brilliance is a gift to Australia.
Whoever, great to have been here.
J-Air is not responsible for the views and opinions expressed by its presenters or guests. J-Air presents a wide variety of views and opinions, which is to the benefit and purpose of community radio.